And I put two slides at the beginning of my presentation, and I did a call and response. And the first slide was, the greenest building is dot, dot, dot. And the second slide was one that is already built. And we went through that like five times. And by the time the fifth time through, I had the lawyers and accountants on their feet.
Welcome to Tangible Remnants, the podcast that makes adaptive reuse exciting, accessible, and sustainable for every building owner. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and a champion of reusing existing buildings. I'm excited that you're here, so let's get into it. Welcome back. Today's episode features a cool conversation between me and Carl Elefante. Now, as many of you may know, Carl is well known within the architecture and preservation circles as the person who coined the phrase, the greenest building is the one that's already built. When I heard that phrase as a student and a young professional, it had such a profound impact on how I saw the connection between historic preservation and sustainability. And I've really enjoyed getting to know Carl over the years through our various professional overlaps, and I am thrilled to be able to share this conversation. In this episode, Carl shares his journey into the field, how his famous phrase came about, as well as what prompted him to write his new book, Going for Zero. We get into the various imperatives he highlights in his book, as well as the responsibility and amazing opportunity that architects have in reusing existing buildings to shape a more sustainable future. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to various items that we discuss and to grab a copy of his book. So let me give you a bit more of Carl's background before we dive in. Carl is a principal emeritus with Quinn Evans. In 2018, he served as the national president of the American Institute of Architects, which was a culmination of leadership positions in architecture, historic preservation, and sustainable design organizations. In 2023, he was the inaugural visiting scholar at the University of Notre Dame's Duda Center for Preservation, Resilience, and Sustainability. He's also a senior fellow with Architecture 2030 and a charter member of the Climate Heritage Network. He is also a fellow of the American Institute of Architects and the Association for Preservation Technology. This was such a fun episode where I got to talk to one of the giants in the sustainable preservation field. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation between me and Carl Elefante. Carl, I am so excited to have you on the podcast. And I'm also excited because a big reason of me learning about sustainability and also that phrase that you are credited with the greenest building is the one that's already built, is something that has been really an inspiration for my career. So I'd love for you to talk about how that phrase came about, as well as even talking about your time at Quinn Evans. I would love for you to talk about your time at Quinn Evans, because you were at Quinn Evans for many years before I joined. But then also talk a little bit about the phrase, the greenest building is the one that's already built.
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of backstory behind it. That I really started my career out focused on green design, sustainability. In a lot of ways, those are sort of new terms. You know, when I was in architecture school was when literally the environmental movement began. I mean, I went to the first Earth Day in 1970. And I came away from a time, by the way, that was very, very difficult time. I mean, you know, the end of the 60s and the early 70s, there was a lot going down, the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement and so on, lots of assassinations and all sorts of horrible things. That the environmental movement was literally the thing that I came out of that experience feeling like there's hope, there's a way forward that would be better for everyone. So for the first half of my architectural career, I really considered architecture as part of the environmental movement. And at that sort of midway point, I had the opportunity to serve on President Clinton's Council on Sustainable Development, one of the millions of working groups that goes into an effort like that. And when I came out of that, I felt like what I was doing in my architectural practice was just simply not a good enough version of what environmental stewardship ought to look like. And I spent about a year trying to understand other people's activities and approaches to what sustainability and environmental stewardship was all about. And one of the people that I talked to was Mike Quinn of Quinn Evans. And I told him about environmental stewardship and, you know, green building. And he told me about the stewardship of the built environment and historic preservation. And we came away from that conversation, both of us believing that it's about time for somebody to bring these two disciplines together and really figure out how they reinforce each other. And within another few months, I literally closed the firm down that I had and went to work with Mike at Quinn Evans. I was the director of sustainability for a historic preservation firm. And at the time, that almost seemed like an oxymoron. It's like, what? That, you know, when I would go to green building events, people would wonder why I was talking about historic preservation. And if I went to historic preservation events, people were wondering why I was talking about sustainability. I have to say, though, less than the other way around, that there was sort of more of a recognition in the historic preservation world of, yes, historic preservation is inherently sustainable, than there was the other way around, you know, that existing buildings were actually an important part of a sustainable built environment future. So in the context of that, it became really clear that trying to bring those two things together was a challenge, and it needed to be reframed. Literally, at a conference in 2004, at that point I'd been up to it for 10 years, with lawyers and accountants talking about historic tax credits, I had a speaking spot right after lunch, and you could just feel the drowsiness in the room. I mean, it was tangible, you know. And I just like, okay, I've got to wake this room up. And it was like, okay, I know what I'll do. And I put two slides at the beginning of my presentation, and I did a call and response. And the first slide was, the greenest building is ... And the second slide was one that is already built. And we went through that like five times. And by the time, the fifth time through, I had the lawyers and accountants on their feet saying, it's one that is already built, you know, it's like, okay, that's a keeper. That obviously resonates.
That's fantastic. And so then, as you were at Quinn Evans and building this kind of reframing to help people understand that, yes, there is this both and of sustainable and historic, how did that keep shaking and shifting the trajectory of your career?
Well, probably the best way to describe that is what was in fact 180-degree turn. I came into, as I described, into a historic preservation firm as a green guy. And I was going to teach those old buildings how to behave. You know, and I was going to apply the accepted ideas of green building to existing and historic buildings. And absolutely did that. I mean, there are aspects of that that are still to this day in my mind completely legitimate. You know, are we thinking about energy efficiency? Are we thinking about envelope performance? Those are important criteria, whether it's an existing building or a newly designed building. But over the course of the years really working with buildings that were 200 years old or 300 years old or even 100 years old, I came to appreciate that traditional architecture, that heritage building, actually had qualities that our new modern era ideas about what good buildings look like had lost. And I actually came away more interested in the lessons that built heritage had to teach modern architecture and the future than what modern ideas could do to improve the performance of historic and older buildings.
Love that. And I'm curious, and I feel like I know the answer to this a little bit, but how did that then inform your trajectory in terms of deciding to run for president of the American Institute of Architects and really trying to bridge that gap between preservation and architects and sustainability?
There's both a sort of a direct and indirect answer to that. The direct is that, you know, in our profession, in our field, the acknowledgement of the importance of existing buildings and the acknowledgement of the importance of historic preservation methodology is still anything but universal. You know, it is still largely not understood. There was that. I mean, we're doing important work as sustainable preservation practitioners, you know, as historic preservation practitioners. We're doing important work. And I felt a mission to have that recognized. But there was also a kind of a more of a wide angle lens, and that is trying to create a new mode of practice, sustainable preservation or sustainable stewardship, kind of got me out of the office. And in a way, in a manner of speaking, it got me into the sort of politics of architecture and land development and real estate, et cetera. What are the policies and accepted ways of going about doing things that influence the outcomes of what we're doing? And what I came to understand is that many of them actually constrain us from doing the best work we could be doing. You know, building codes don't help us do the best work we can doing. Zoning ordinances don't help us do the best work we can doing. We can do, gosh, the financial structure of the development world absolutely doesn't help us do the best work we can do. So I realized that there was a mission to not just practice well, but to really get architects organized as a cohort to raise our voices about these things that we know are keeping us from doing the best work we can do. Why are we fighting those things? Why aren't those things actually helping us? Why aren't they conceived and implemented and conducted in ways that actually help us do really valuable, good work? So that got me into recognizing the importance of really taking on leadership roles in organizations like AI.
And like through that role, you became such a bigger visible expert and almost kind of known as, oh, that's the sustainable preservation guy. And so I love that you've been able to really leverage that and have the connections that you've made around the world, from even Global North to Global South, some of the work that you're doing with the Climate Heritage Network and Architecture 2030. And I'm so grateful to you that you've taken kind of the knowledge that you've learned through your experience and put it into this fantastic book that I really feel like should be on the shelves and in the hands of every first year designer, real estate professional, anyone who's doing anything with the built environment or wants to. And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about what prompted you to write the book Going for Zero before we get into a little bit more of the book itself.
Well, what prompted me was having those experiences and really fully appreciating, having been a practicing architect for 50 years, that for architects to pay attention to anything but the project that's on their desk that day is very difficult. It's such a demanding profession. It's very rewarding, but it's also very demanding. And in creating this new mode of practice that I did at Quinn Evans, literally part of my day job was to get out of the office and go, you know, talk the talk about the importance of what we're doing. So it gave me the opportunity to literally spend three decades looking over the horizon and seeing what the future was asking us to do and to understand the big patterns of what were affecting our profession and what were really the challenges and opportunities that we faced. Literally, it was a day in 2015 where I was sitting in the boardroom at the AIA headquarters, and I looked around the room and asked myself, who remembers the things that we've talked about for the last 3 years? Who really, you know, really gets it that we just started important work here? We haven't finished it. We've just started it. And I looked around the room and I realized it was me, and that I had a responsibility to really share that special privileged path that I got to take, you know, that I got to think about things other than the projects on my desk. And so that led me to the AIA leadership experience. And then when I was done with that, like, am I done sharing? Like, no. Have I said everything that needs to be said? No. Has everybody heard what needs to be heard even more so? No. So, you know, obviously, you know, one of the ways to really get attention in our world is to be recognized in authority by publishing a book on the topic. And I would say that even though only 1 in 100 architects ever reads a book, you know, and in our world, only 1 in 1,000 people, you know, reads a book these days, the credibility that you get as a serious enough minded person to have put enough effort and put enough years and energy into actually publishing a book on a topic is a really important thing. I mean, it gives you status. It gives you, it brings attention to you. It gives your words interest and authority. It gives your words authority that you wouldn't have without it. And so going from those leadership positions and that practice to publishing a book was a very logical step for me.
I have plenty of fun with the relevance revolution too, I can tell you for sure.
So a lot of the core of the book is really the relevance revolution and how do we keep architects and architecture relevant and how do we actually be aware of what's happening in our world so that we're not just focused on the projects that fade head down like many architects are. And so talk a little bit about the difference the different revolutions that you outlined in the book that you're seeing for addressing the 21st century imperatives.
In a lot of ways, this is something that you can say, yes, this is a theme in my book, or this is something that is important about what my book is saying. But I can tell you, it's not something that I'm inventing. It's not something that I have created. It's something that I simply have observed. The central realities that have created this revolution for what we do as the shapers of the built environment is that civilization has reached a point where there are simply so many people in the world that the only viable path forward is for us to urbanize. And it's interesting, we're at this threshold. The 21st century really represents a threshold in the 6,000 years of civilization, you know, that we've been building as a race, you know, building as a species. So in 2000, for the first time in human history, half of global population lived in urbanized areas. By the end of the century, almost 9 in 10 people will. And to just put a number on that, half of the population in 2000 was 3 billion people. 9/10 of the population in 2100 is 11 billion people. So we're going to house another 8 billion people in cities during this century, going from 3 billion to 11 billion people in cities. So that simply means that everything that defines human experience is an urban factor. Every problem that we're going to face is going to need an urban solution to it. You know, we don't need to define our own relevance in that. We just need to seize the relevance that is being thrust upon us. It amazes me as I go around talking, and especially as I go to architecture schools, how little awareness there is of this pattern of urbanization that is, again, it's thrust upon us as architects. And so the simply coming to the reality of the urban future is beyond generational. It's sort of the before that and now forevermore. You know, this is the urban reality of human civilization. And in trying to understand what it means and what can the impact of our work be in this urban century, in trying to understand what the impact really means for us who shape the built environment, the obvious one is climate change. You know, and climate change is, in a way, a very simple, straightforward proposition. For the last 200 years, we have been inserting fossil fuels into everything about the built environment and everything we do, into transportation, into agriculture, into industry, into habitation. And it's been, for good reason, it helped us do a lot of things. We've inserted fossil fuels into absolutely everything we do, including the built environment. And we know that the repercussion of that is climate change. It's burning fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. There's no escaping that. It's just the science. It's just what is happening and will happen for as long as we keep on using carbon-based fuels the way we use them. So what it means for us in the built environment is we have to retool everything about how we design and construct and operate our buildings. You know, so everything is a big job. Some of it is very simple retweaking. You know, there's not a lot that needs to change. Other parts of it are profound. We really need to have electric-only buildings. We can't have fossil fuels in our buildings anymore. So there are aspects of this that are really big and very difficult and long-term. There are other aspects that are very simple and straightforward and relatively easily accomplished. But so the proposition for climate change for us who shape the built environment is that we have to retool everything. We have to do it everywhere. And it will shape the lives of everyone. So everything, everywhere, everyone. That's daunting. That's a very, very big job. Very, very big job. But it's actually quite doable if we put our minds to it. And if we stop fighting all those systems I was talking about before, and those systems are actually adapted to make it so that proper climate outcomes, among many other outcomes, are not just possible, but encouraged. It's entirely doable. And I talk a lot about that in the book. So with the proposition of retooling everything everywhere and impacting the lives of everyone, like, well, if we're going to impact the lives of everyone, like, what's the condition that we're working in? You know, what do we know about the conditions that we're working in?
Want to learn more about the unknown ladies of architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp!
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools. Women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
And that's where the justice imperative comes in. And again, just like the urban imperative, this is not something that I'm inventing. It's not something that I came up with. And in fact, in the 1980s, there was a publication called Our Common Future, which was the outcome of the Brundtland Commission, a UN commission on economics and environment, that was led by Gro Harlem Brundtland, who had been she had been the prime minister of Norway. So her job for given her by Javier de Cuellar, who was the Secretary General of the UN in 1987, was to find a way to bring economic concerns, development concerns, and environmental concerns together, you know, and how could we have development and not have negative environmental consequences be the inevitable outcome of them. When she met that challenge, she basically said, hold on, wait a minute, there's another one. There's also social factors. We have to understand the impact on people. So what are the impacts of development, not just on the natural environment, but how about the effects on people? So the idea of sustainable development that was defined in our common future, today, we've sort of tweaked our understanding of the three legs of the stool of economic and social and environmental. Environmental is now really dominated by this question of climate action. You know, we have to take care of climate change. We have to do it quickly. And it's not the only environmental issue that we face by any means, but it's a very urgent one, and it's one that, you know, we can focus on and take care of. On the social side, the same year that the climate summit happened, the Paris climate summit happened, 2015, there was a UN summit called the Sustainable Development Summit that adopted the 2030 sustainability agenda. A lot of people know about the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, and in a lot of ways, it's kind of a bill of rights for the citizens of the world. You know, we recognize that people suffer poverty, they suffer hunger, they suffer from lack of education, lack of housing, etc. All of these things actually prevent people from being able to live healthy and productive lives. There's really no good that comes from people in the world not living healthy and productive lives. The world would be better off if everyone had the opportunity to live healthy and productive lives. So the Sustainable Development Goals, the justice imperative, really is what would it take to imagine a world in which everyone could live healthy and productive lives? And, you know, the 2030 agenda, you know, sustainable development agenda is basically an outline for what a justice imperative action agenda really looks like. So if we're going to retool everything everywhere and impact the lives of everyone, shouldn't we have everyone leading healthy and productive lives as our goal, not just changing greenhouse gas emission? And so that's really what it's about. And hey, by the way, everything that's going to happen is going to happen in cities. Okay, architects, there it is. There's our future. You know, we must respond to the climate imperative. While we're at it, it's an opportunity to address the justice imperative, and we have to do it because we are on the front line in wagers of peace in the urban imperative.
Yeah. And I love that you framed it that way, because it does build on all of the work that has come before, but also it is able to encapsulate it in a way that is digestible and easy to understand. Because I think that's one of the things that oftentimes people make this more complicated than it needs to be, or they don't see the connection between existing buildings and the climate imperative and justice, and well, how does this compare to that? How are they all connected? But everything really is connected in terms of our common future. And there's a quote that I was actually reading something from, it was a Bill McDonough quote from like 2003, where he was talking about how do we love all children for all species for all time? And the idea of like, how do we actually think about this from multiple layers. And so I love that your book also highlights that and helps to reframe it for the new generation of for the new generation of students and stewards of the built environment and the world in general. So with thinking about the different imperatives and also thinking about stewardship, talk a little bit more about our modern era biases in the built environment, particularly as we're thinking about the economic, environmental, and even social benefits of reuse.
So in a lot of ways, one of the things that is probably the greatest provocation in my book for architects and the others who shape the built environment is the talk about the imperative to is our need to get beyond modern era practices. Let me just go off on a little bit of a tangent to say that when you look back at the evolution of cities, and particularly our era, the evolution of the modern city, it's amazing that it sort of falls into these 80-year cycles. I mean, sometime when I get a lot more time, I want to look back at how often the 80-year cycle has sort of manifested itself. Mm-hmm. You know, in our world, there's been this 80-year cycle of creating the modern world. And the first 80 years of it was literally kind of coincidental with the founding of the AIA. That was a little before 1860. At that point, the industrial city had sort of existed for a while, and people were moving to cities because there were jobs there, or there, you know, the kind of agricultural world of peasants and, you know, living in that sort of the agricultural world was ending, and workers living in urban environments was happening. So that sort of first era, what I like to term modern era 1.0, recognizing that cities had to be reformed to accommodate this new crowding of people. And it was a real sense that cities could do the job. In the United States, we had a thing that we called the City Beautiful movement. That was sort of that, what that was about. You know, there's a lot of people who talk about the reforms that took place in Paris, Baron von Haussmann sort of creating a modern era Paris, et cetera. Then you get to the stock market crash and the Depression and, you know, sort of the next generation with Corbusier and Frank Lloyd Wright, Mies van der Rohe, and so on. They were actually urban rejectionists. Modern City 2.0 was really built on theories that said cities are dead, traditional cities are going to be replaced by a new version of city, and Corbusier's version of that was 60-story towers instead of Paris, and Frank Lloyd Wright's version of that was suburbia instead of urban cities. And it even goes all the way to Robert Moses, you know, bulldozing neighborhoods to create freeways, et cetera. And so the last 80 years has literally been the post-World War II multiplication, replication of that modern era city where cars come first and buildings are heated and air conditioned with fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. And so this post-World War II city that we've been building for 80 years, it's literally time for us to like get on to the next thing. And it's just interesting to me that there's sort of coincidence of timing. So today we're faced with 80 years of post-World War II development. We know what it can do. We also know what it can't do. We know the majesty that it created. And we also know the intransigent problems that we created. And it's time to get on to the next thing. So it's time to move away from buildings that are machines for living and cities that are for driving cars in. You know, it's on to the next thing. And, you know, what do we want to be? Do we want to be neighbors or traffic? You know, do we want to have cities for people or cities for cars? You know, it's time for us to move on. And that mode shift is literally what we're facing. When do we implement it? How do we implement it? How quickly do we implement that mode shift?
Yeah. And I'm optimistic that what we create next has the opportunity and actually will be something that is more just for everyone and not just a subset of the elite class. And I'm optimistic that there becomes less harm that's done through the built environment. And we actually do move into a portion of healing the built environment, healing communities through design and through how we do shape the future. Because we have the know-how, we have the knowledge, we have the ability to do so now. It's just whether or not we're going to have the will. So I'm trying to be cautiously optimistic. But we'll see what happens, I guess.
And there's reason, yeah, too, to be optimistic about it and to really think that that this isn't just a moment of challenges. It's a moment of challenge and opportunity. And so it's not coincidental at all that these 80 years of really, really historic development that have taken place, not just here in the U.S., but around the world since the conclusion of World War II. As I said, we know what that modern era development can do. We also know what it can't do. I have not been to a city anywhere in the world or a town anywhere in the world that, as a result of this 80 years of development, doesn't have wounds that need to be healed, doesn't have things that have disintegrated the fabric of the city. So the notion in my book that we really need to get to this mode of reintegration and healing, again, it's not this pie in the sky idea. It's observation, boots on the ground. What are the conditions in our cities? And the mode change to really thinking about reintegration and healing as priorities is very practical. And one dimension to it is sort of the economic challenge that it presents. And we're actually seeing this in the building sector in a really interesting way. Well, 2022 was the first year when the AIA, that has been tracking architectural fees for about 25 years, found that architectural fees for existing building work were greater than architectural fees for new building design. And that's historic. You know, that it think that pattern had only existed in times of really bad economic strife, when people literally couldn't afford to build new buildings, and the percentage of building rehab invariably sort of by comparison went up. But 2022 was a time when, with COVID, we certainly had a new world upon us. So 2022 presented this sort of historic moment when existing building work exceeded new building work in terms of architectural fees. There's what Storm Cunningham, an economist who just passed away, unfortunately, this year, talked about. When you look at the economic sectors across the full spectrum, I think it was 13 or 18 economic sectors that he analyzed, all of them have a pattern like that, that along with the progress that has happened, there's also been damage that literally needs to be fixed, needs to be healed, whether it's, you know, waterway pollution or air pollution or the disintegration of, we talk about our infrastructure and, you know, bridges that need to be repaired and things like that. His proposition was that restorative economic activity is now in a position today where it exceeds expansive development economic activity. So we're just sort of part of that pattern.
That's interesting.
We're part of that pattern, yeah, in the built environment. We have healing and reintegration to do.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I want to say one other thing about reintegration. Again, I feel, you know, I'm using both healing and reintegration in very straightforward ways. Our cities have been disintegrated. Part of it has been things like running highways right through the middle of our cities and towns. Gosh, I was in Providence not long ago. That city is literally, it's like the walled city of Providence. It has freeways cutting it into little pieces that are almost impossible to cross. You know, it's just the city that's just been divided by the great walls of China that we call interstate highways, just absolutely cut apart. And so that's one way that we've disintegrated our city. We've literally ripped the fabric of our cities apart. But another way that we've disintegrated them is racial and economic, segregation. Racial and economic segregation, which was largely intentional. And if you look at the history of zoning, go back to the 1910, 1920, when the concept of exclusionary zoning, and that was the term that was used, exclusionary zoning was being created. The whole idea was to exclude obnoxious and toxic land uses from favored land uses. And in the end, the reality of that was separating cities economically into rich and poor sections. And guess where all the obnoxious stuff ended up? Guess where all the toxic stuff ended up? It ended up next to the poor neighborhoods. And by the way, mostly neighborhoods where racial minorities lived. And it was
right,
intentional. And
the neighborhoods where they were only allowed to live.
Yeah. Right. And redlining. Redlining took place into the 60s until the Fair Housing Act basically said they weren't legal anymore. You know, so right. This is an ancient
history.
And the effects
of redlining are still seen today. Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, so it's like it's in law versus a de facto, but there's still the remnants of it are definitely still in play today.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, both the term reintegrating and healing are used in a very straightforward way in the book. And they are both issues that we have to address in urban, you know, in the modern city 3.0, in the next generation of urbanizing our city, re-urbanizing our cities.
Absolutely. So as wrapping up, I know you also have a section in the book that talks about if the past teaches and kind of the idea of, you know, what does the future learn? And that there's this book actually titled, If the Past Teaches, What Does the Future Learn? But I guess let's talk a little bit about architecture superpower and kind of regionally adapted habitation and also bioclimatic design as we are wrapping up and thinking through how do we tie this back to the physical buildings and how we actually reuse them.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, I ended up having the opportunity to, you know, learn a little from the heritage building world because I was involved in historic preservation. And, you know, it really gave me the opportunity to, you know, really not just study built heritage, but to interact with it, to, you know, to understand what really had lasting value about it. And, you know, what did you need to do to take care of buildings that were 100 or 200 or 300 years old? There's many places in the world where a 300-year-old building is a new building. For us, it's an ancient building. And there were a few things that I found that I think are, you know, kind of profound and important. The first is simply being good stewards of the building stock. We are sort of staggeringly wasteful in the built environment. In the United States, on an average year, we demolish 800,000 buildings. And the statistic that really blows my mind is that construction waste and demolition waste by tonnage is more than double all the municipal waste in the entire country combined. More than double. Now, you know, hey, oh, it's cheating. Concrete weighs a lot compared to municipal waste, compared to, you know, paper cups and, you know, plastic bottles. Yes. But still, twice all municipal waste combined, right. It's staggering. We just throw buildings out at the drop of a hat. So I simply came to value the importance of simply rescuing buildings from getting thrown in the trash, often for no good reason at all. And so the other thing I came to appreciate is like, well, okay, they're still valuable, but what does generations of buildings really give us? And, you know, people get on an airplane and they go to a place like Rome, the Eternal City. Why? Because to be in places where the layers of time are literally there to be experienced, that you can walk the streets that people have walked for 1,000 years, you can experience firsthand, personally, intimately, compellingly, your connection with hundreds of generations. It's one of the most compelling human experiences that there is. That's why so many people get on planes and go to places like Rome. So it's architecture's superpower. And looking forward, it's even more important in terms of architecture's superpower, not just looking back, and recognizing that the buildings that we create today, the building code tells us they have to be earthquake-proof, storm-proof, fire-proof, even bomb-proof. We are creating buildings that are mostly made out of materials that will last forever. And do we think about that when we design our buildings? Do we think about 60% or 70% of the building that I'm building is made out of materials that will last forever? And therefore, I need to design them so they will retain value for not just dozens of years, but hundreds of years. Most architects, for most buildings, the answer to that is no. It's the rare building that actually is being designed with the designers thinking about its lasting value being generations and generations. And so that both in a sort of ethereal way that, you know, we have this wonderful experience of experiencing heritage firsthand, et cetera. And then in a real material way that, you know, we're making buildings that last, let's make that have value that lasts as well. Both sides of that are enormously important.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. Until next time, remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.